The opinions expressed in the following program are the sole responsibility of the host and its guests, and not the responsibility of the advertisers or Lee Family Broadcasting or K-Bar Radio. Good evening and welcome to Straight Talk and Cool Classics 1230 KBAR Burley and In the Dark with Bill Shields.
Please stop wasting people's precious time with your stupid little jokes.
Prepare yourself for a radio experience like none other as Bill Shields takes you into the dark.
I hate it when he does that.
From the paranormal to the abnormal. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the rest of the evening on Straight Talk and Cool Classics 1230 KBAR Burley.
All right, ladies, it's time for you to meet the men.
And now, Bill Shields.
Hey, welcome to a Monday night edition of In the Dark. I am your host, Bill Shields. We're going to go directly to the phones right now. We got a very special guest with us tonight. It's Roy Schumann. How are you doing tonight, Roy?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I was going to our booking book of all the guests we have available, and yours just struck me. The connection between Nazi Germany and the rampant anti-Semitism going on in the Middle East and with the Arab nations, and the connection between the two. And, you know, I had never put those two together. Never in a million years would I ever expect there to be a connection between the two. But
it's quite mysterious to me that it's so little known, but the connection is extremely intimate and goes back almost virtually 100 years. It goes back about 80 years to the very beginning of the Nazis.
So, yeah, you got to just give us all the details, because, you know, it's, I find it fascinating and amazing, but once, you know, your eyes are open to the fact that it's a very, you know, real connection, it is possible. It is more than possible, it's very probable.
Well, the easiest way actually to get a handle on the connection is to begin by focusing on a particular individual who was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, made the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem in 1921, called Amin al-Husseini. And when he was still just the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem in 21 and then again in 29, he started pogroms against the Jews, first in 21, organizing pogroms that killed Jews in Jaffa and Rehovot, and then in 29, a massacre of Jews in Hebron and in Haifa and Safed and Tel Aviv. And then in 1933, when Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, Husseini, the same Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, sent a telegram to Berlin asking for permission to start a local Nazi Arab party, and actually met with a German consul, a man named Wolf, to make his request. And he was initially turned down, but then in 36, he started getting very active support from Nazi Germany.
Amazing.
He actually, well, I can continue a little bit with the rough outlines. Nazi Germany started supplying him with arms and money. He started the Arab Revolt in 36 to try to get rid of all the Jews in Palestine. That was put down by the British. Then he started, the same man, the Mufti, tried to launch a pro-Nazi coup in Iraq, which actually initially succeeded. This is now in 1941, but again the British put it down soon afterwards. At that point, Husseini had to flee to Berlin, and he was put up by Hitler in royal surroundings for 3 years, given a huge salary, and made propaganda on Berlin Nazi radio to all the Muslims to kill the Jews. He set up a special SS division for Hitler of Bosnian Muslims who proceeded to, among other things, kill all the Serbs and Jews they could in Bosnia. And he actually recruited 100,000 Muslims for the Nazi army. And there was testimony at the Nuremberg trials that suggested that it was actually Husseini who convinced Hitler to implement the final solution and to exterminate the Jews, because up till that point, Hitler had considered simply expelling the Jews, but Husseini was very worried that many of them would end up in Palestine. And there was actually Eichmann's deputy at his Nuremberg trial said that it was the Mufti who forced Hitler's hand to resolve on the actual extermination of the Jews.
Wow. Now, you've detailed this connection plus many other things in your new book, correct?
That's correct. Now, the book is called Salvation is from the Jews, The Role of Judaism in Salvation History from Abraham to the Second Coming. It's put out by Ignatius Press, and I also have a website with the same title, salvationisfromthejews.com.
And now, you started off life as a Jewish follower, correct?
That's right. I'm born and raised Jewish. Actually, my parents are Holocaust refugees from Germany.
But you converted to Catholicism. Boy, I'll say that right yet. You became a Catholic.
I entered the Catholic Church. That's right.
What made you made that decision? And now the book, you know, Salvation is from the Jews. Who's it aimed towards? Is it the Christian population, the Judaism, or both?
Well, I'm tempted to say, kind of as a joke, everyone but Muslims. But it's initially when I sat down to write it, I kind of had in mind Jews to actually demonstrate to my fellow Jews that they can't even begin to appreciate the true importance and glory of Judaism until they see it as the religion which brought us God incarnated as man and brought salvation to the whole world, in other words, through the lens of Christianity. But much to my surprise, it found a very responsive chord in Christian readers, and I've gotten hundreds of letters and emails from Christian readers who have just said that it's illuminated their own Christianity in much greater depth, and for the first time they read the Old Testament and it really comes alive, and they see the importance of it, and they see the integral connection between Judaism and Christianity.
Now, can you describe the role of Judaism in salvation history and the destiny of the world?
In 25 words or less, sure.
Sure.
The easy part is the role of Judaism prior to the incarnation of Christ, because we can see the central role of Judaism, in some sense, was to prepare for the incarnation of God as man, to prepare a people who would be able to receive Him, who would know enough about the one true God, would have a high enough moral behavior, would worship and pray to God for the coming of the Messiah, and who would provide a people into which He could incarnate, and who would then understand Him and what He brought to earth well enough to propagate the religion and to essentially be the first apostles and the first generation of Christians. The incarnation itself, if someone's familiar with the Old Testament and the book of Genesis, the incarnation itself came about, one could say, in as God's reciprocation of Abraham's fidelity to God and willingness to sacrifice his son Isaac. So that entire relationship between mankind and God, which reached fruition in the incarnation, was begun by essentially the beginning, with the beginning of the Jewish people, with Abraham's relationship to God. There isn't much controversial really about the absolutely central role that Judaism had in bringing about the incarnation and being the religion of Jesus. The more controversial part and the more difficult part is there any role for Judaism after the coming of Christ in salvation history? And I think the evidence is quite clear that there is. That's where the historical thread in my book comes in, and as a matter of fact, that's where this discussion of the relationship between Arab anti-Semitism and Nazism comes in, because I would argue that there are many sources of evidence that Judaism still has a role to play in the economy of salvation, essentially in between the first coming and the second coming and leading up to the second coming. Some of that evidence is in Scripture and in the letters of Paul. He makes some fairly direct commentary and analysis which suggests that Judaism has a role to play in the Second Coming. But an indirect kind of evidence is the incredible satanic attack on Jews and Judaism almost continually over the last 2,000 years, and in some sense culminating with the Holocaust. And I would argue that the Jews should be, far too insignificant a people and a population to kind of have the the role on the world stage that they have, and to be getting all the heat they've always gotten from these apparently diabolically inspired attacks.
Yeah, where do these that's a great term, diabolically inspired attacks. I'm going to have to remember that one. Where did it start, though? What was the main catalyst that thrust the Jews into such a hated role on the world stage?
Well, I would say there are a couple of ways to look at it, but one is, obviously I'm speaking from a Christian perspective, right? I can't continually apologize for that. Jesus was a Jew, right?
Right.
Jesus was God made man. It's Jesus who essentially won the battle for all time against Satan. So the hatred that Satan has for God and the hatred that Satan has for Jesus, he can't really do much directly against God or directly against Jesus. The closest he can come is by attacking his family, essentially, which is the Jews.
A very interesting concept. I never thought of it that way, but it makes sense. Now, back to the Nazi thing for a moment. Now, we never hear anything about the Muslims being involved in World War II and everything. Why has this been so glossed over in our history, do you think?
That frankly is a mystery to me. It is a mystery to me. Nowadays, of course, much of the Western world wants to put as positive a spin as possible on the Arab world. Perhaps that was a factor even 50, 60 years ago. But I really don't know because a tremendous amount of evidence came out both in the Nuremberg trials and in the Eichmann trial, witness after witness who spoke about the role of Husseini, and then following, well, I'll just give another small example, maybe not that small, a man called Franz Stengel, who was the commandant of Treblinka. Now, Treblinka concentration camp, I don't want to sound flip, but made Auschwitz look like a summer camp. I mean, Auschwitz, at least the deportees who were sent to Auschwitz were at least taken off the train and put into barracks and only killed over a course of weeks. After Treblinka, they didn't even have barracks for them. You know, 5,000 people came in a day off the train, and they had barracks for about 200 people who were the inmates who were working there, and all 5,000 a day just went straight from the train to these, burning pits that they were forced into.
That is horrible.
And the commandant of Treblinka fled to Syria and was protected by the Syrian government and refused extradition. It's kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, I'd say so. So it was Husseini, I believe you said the gentleman's name was?
Husseini was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Let me just say one other thing about Husseini, which is most people are not familiar with Husseini, but they're quite familiar with his nephew, who took the name Yasser Arafat.
Really? Amazing.
Yasser Arafat was a 17-year-old living with his uncle. I'm using uncle in the Middle Eastern sense. In other words, it's not like a parent's brother, but it's some, second or third uncle.
Right.
He was living with him in Cairo after the war, and started out as an arms runner for him, and then was put in charge of smuggling the arms for his uncle Husseini, and worked his way up to where he is now. But he idolized Husseini, and he actually, even recently, in 2002, in a Palestinian newspaper, he called al-Husseini his hero and proudly bragged that he was one of his troops. He at another point in his public speech said it was an honor to follow in his footsteps.
Amazing.
It's incredible stuff to me that it's as obscure as it is.
Yeah, that's, and especially in this day and age, the information age, everything, we know what's going on in the world. We don't know this bit of history. And I, in my opinion, that is, boy, I wish I could spit this out. It plays a very prominent part in a lot of the way that we perceive the Arabs and how they perceive the Jews.
There's basically a big lie going on, which is that the root of the Arab hostility to the Jews is the existence of the State of Israel and the desire of the Palestinians to have their own land. And history doesn't support that view, because the desire to exterminate the Jews on the part of the Arab world long predates the State of Israel and long predates the Palestinians. And already, as I said, in the 1920s, Husseini was launching campaigns to exterminate the Jews. And in fact, one of the reasons why he made his alliance with Hitler was because he was smart enough to realize that it was kind of harder to kill the Jews, for him to kill the Jews in Palestine, than for Hitler to kill the Jews before they got to Palestine.
And, you know, we have been taught, you know, especially since 9/11, when America became aware of what was going on over in that part of the world at such a level, that it's always been an ongoing hatred between the Jews and the Muslims since the beginning of time.
Well, to some extent that's true, but I don't want to appear chauvinistic, but it's not a symmetric situation. The Jews never had a problem with Muslims living alongside them, although, of course, they want the State of Israel to be a Jewish state, and therefore they want to protect the right of Jews to immigrate there in a special way. But it's in the Quran itself that Islam cannot tolerate the presence of an infidel in its midst. It's sacrilege to allow an infidel to live in the Muslim world, unless they're living in a state of what's called demitude, of explicit subservience to the Muslims.
And so that would also explain quite a bit of how Husseini was able to rally these people. I guess he was almost a modern day kind of jihad kind of dude.
Well, jihad is not new. I mean, the first jihad kind of dude was Muhammad himself, right?
Right. Oh, I find that amazing, just simply amazing that these facts haven't made it out there.
Well, today I understand why, because the U.S. government has a kind of vested interest in pretending that the problem is not Islam.
They're lying to us then, because that it is the problem is Islam. It's the religion. It's what they teach.
It's a big part of the problem. I think the only hope, the only way you can say the problem isn't Islam, is the hope that the Muslims become as bad Muslims as the Christians have become Christians.
Now you're making me feel bad, Roy.
Well, I didn't mean it personally. You know what I mean.
Yeah,
you know, if they take Islam as casually as most American, say, Catholics take Catholicism, then everyone could live peacefully side by side. But if they take it as seriously, you know, as a devout Catholic takes his religion and, you know, refuses contraception and so forth, then we're all in trouble.
Well, that seems like a lot of the problem now is they do take it so seriously. Is there any chance outside of that of these two cultures ever being able to get along, to mesh in any way, shape, or form?
I don't think. I mean, it's in Islam's own definition of itself that it has to take the world over by force. That's the basic imperative. Just like the basic imperative for the Christian, you know, Jesus is called the Great Commission. You know, Jesus's almost his last words were, "Go out and make disciples of all nations," and just like the Great Commission in Christianity is to go and evangelize all the nations, the Great Commission in Islam is to go and subdue all the nations and make them into Muslims, either by conversion if that works or by force if it doesn't work. So I don't think there really is a way that basically what I'm saying is, short of conversion or a great apostasy from Islam, I don't think there's a way.
That is extremely scary.
Well, there is an answer, which we've been promised, which is the second coming. But I think it's pretty easy if you take the scripture seriously, to read them nowadays and to see Armageddon as essentially being the war between Islam and the rest of the world.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that's what all of this is leading to every day. It seems
you're afraid, I'm hoping, but we certainly see things the same way.
Well, yeah, I don't want to see the end of the world. I don't want to see Armageddon hit any time in the near future.
Well, hey, you have to go through Armageddon to get to the second coming.
Oh, that's true. Well, that's... Boy, I just... You know, I got to tell you, Roy, that thought scares the bejesus out of me. to say the least. Now, how's the response to the book been so far? Have you heard anything from the Arab communities at all? Are they...
No, and I think what's protecting me is I don't think a whole lot of Muslims run out to buy a book called Salvationist from the Jews.
Well, you know, but isn't half of the battle knowing your enemy? I mean, if I was a Muslim and I saw this, I'd want to know what the hell you were thinking. What you were teaching.
Don't let them know.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll tell you a little secret, Roy. There's not a whole hell of a lot of Muslims in Idaho, so.
Well, anyway, the other reason I feel relatively safe is I'm way down on the list. There are a lot of books exposing Islam coming out nowadays.
You know, and we just got a copy of a book here that I think you'd find pretty interesting. It's the Illustrated Guide to Islam, and how Muhammad described, you know, fetuses in the womb with his limited knowledge, and how great Islam is, and how we all need to convert. And it scared me. They sent me this in the mail, and boy, that really bothered me.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the idea of them recruiting in America right now, you know, I grew up in the 70s. I had a teacher that was a black Muslim, and she was hard on the white kids and just really would not cut us any slack. And, you know, but we were told we had to tolerate that because, you know, religious differences, and that's okay. Has religious freedom gone too far in this country that we're allowing the Muslims as much freedom as we do and that we all are paying for it currently?
I wouldn't use the word freedom because when it comes to the point, I mean, obviously, I think that the refusal to engage in any kind of profiling, for instance, in air travel, I mean, that's got to be ludicrous, right? I mean, if a 70-year-old grandmother from Iowa with, you know, gray blonde hair is searched as thoroughly as a 25-year-old Middle Eastern-looking young man to get on an airplane, you know, that's just a waste of effort and a hole in security.
You know, and the whole anti-profiling thing is just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. It's not. It's like you said, it ain't 80-year-old grandmothers that are blowing up planes and driving them into buildings.
That's right. I mean, it turns everything into a joke. I wouldn't call that, that's not freedom of religion, right? That's kind of political correctness run amok, and I would say that at the point where, for instance, it becomes unacceptable for the FBI to infiltrate mosques, even though everyone knows that mosques are the kind of infrastructure for organizing, you know, terrorist cells.
And the breeding ground for them, too.
That's right. That's no longer freedom of religion. That's political correctness run amok.
True. All right, we got to take a quick break. Roy, if you can hang on a minute, we'll be right back. All right, you're listening to In the Dark on Straight Talking Cool Classics 1230 KBAR and on the Internet. We're going to take your calls for Roy at 436-2244, 1-800-724-5288, right after these messages. Welcome back to In the Dark. I'm Straight Talking Cool Classics, 1230 KBAR, Burley, and on the Internet. Taking your calls for Roy Schumann at 436-2244, 1-800-724-5288. Feel free to call in anything you want. Now, are you working on any other books, a follow-up to this one?
Well, I am working on a book. It's a follow-up from a kind of inward perspective, from a theological perspective, rather from an external world events perspective. I'm beginning work on a book about essentially sexuality as the ultimate battleground between good and evil.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a very interesting concept right there.
I think that when the history of mankind will have been written, we'll see that sexuality was the Achilles heel, and in some sense, of absolute prime importance to God and his plan, and also of prime importance to the adversary in his plan for destroying humanity.
You know, that is that is pretty much every man's weakness at one point or another. That's man's weakness in general.
That is, and again, if you take the Bible seriously, it's what causes to just, you know, God's wrath more than anything else.
True. All right, we got a call for you. Go ahead, go ahead, caller.
Hi, I can hardly hear you.
Okay, let me...
Nope.
All right, go ahead, Virginia.
I can't hear you.
You should be able to. There you go.
No. Anyway, off talk and you tell him I can't hear him or you either very well. I agree with everything he said about, you know, Hitler and the Jews and the Muslims, and that's what I understood too. And the added thing was, you know, the Germans were just coming out of a depression from World War One, and Hitler saw that he wasn't a German, was he? He was something else.
Well, Austrian, technically.
Yes. And he got his German and birth certificate, you know, when he decided he was going to run the world. But he decided that the Jewish people had all you know, the special talents and money, like they were doctors and lawyers and tailors. You know, they were educated people,
mm-hmm.
and had money and paintings and stuff like that. And he decided he needed that, you know, for his world takeover thing.
That's right. It was a tremendous source of wealth, yeah.
Yes, and I think that's why some people, I don't know why that's carried on from the Second World War, but it has, you know, that the Jews are the ones that make the money. You know, I don't know why that's carried on.
Well, there's some truth to it, not in the sense that justifies anti-Semitism, but it is true that Jews have a disproportionately high profile. They are obviously, if you look at any, you know, at a university setting, at medicine, at banking,
yes.
there's a disproportionate percentage of Jews, and
yes.
and that can cause a kind of negative reaction in some people, a resentment and a hostility.
Well, see, and to me, that's just admiration. I would just think that was wonderful. The other thing is, I believe that the Jewish people were the chosen ones, and they still are.
And that's coming from a Catholic.
Yes, I'm a Catholic,
well,
too.
You might be interested in my book, because that's exactly, you know, kind of the point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I heard that. And then, but a concept I hadn't even thought of before was, you know, after Christ comes, what will the Jewish people play in that? Because if they're the chosen people, obviously they're going to carry on. And I hadn't even thought about that. So I want to get your book, and I want to read more about that. And
great.
I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, I hadn't even thought about that. I'm just worried about America going to hell.
Excuse me?
I was just worried about America going to hell. I hadn't even thought about when the second coming, you know, and Jesus and the Jews.
Well, the happy ending that we're assured of is the second coming. It may get a little bit dark in between now and then.
Yes, that's the truth. Well, you know, it doesn't matter whether you get hit by a car tomorrow or, you know, you die in a war. It's all the same. And this is just part of living where we are now.
Yeah, that's right. It's not the biggest part. The biggest part is the part that begins after we die.
Yes.
Okay, Virginia, thank you for the call.
Yeah, and you keep track of that, and I'll look up on your computer so I can get the book, Bill.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, taking your calls for Roy at 436-2244, 1-800-724-5288. Now, you know, Virginia brought up a very interesting point. If the Jews are the chosen few, the chosen people, where does that leave the rest of Christianity at?
Well, it's not an inferior situation. I mean, again, what essentially what St. Paul says is that the Jews are like God's children by nature, and the Gentiles are God's children by adoption. An image that St. Paul uses, the ingrafting, that, you know, that the humanity, the saved humanity is like an olive tree, and the Gentiles are branches that are grafted in. The Jews are the native branches of the olive tree. But once the Gentiles were grafted into the tree, they're part of the tree too in the same way.
Okay. Where does this leave the Muslims, though? You know, I just really can't, you know, phantom the idea that an entire belief system would be so wrong that it would condemn every believer in it to an eternity in hell.
I don't think there's any question that there are thousands of Muslims who, in their individual morality and virtue and love of God, you know, put Christians and Jews to shame. In that sense, I agree with you completely. Why the extent to which God favors one religion over another is a bit of a mystery to me. It does seem that it's important for the ultimate relationship with God to be sacramentally related to Him in the right way. And if one takes the words of Jesus in the New Testament seriously, it's very important to believe in Jesus. That doesn't mean it's the end of the world and no possibility of salvation if one doesn't, but it's certainly a huge leg up.
Now, you had a dramatic conversion experience. You care to share that with us?
Sure. It was very dramatic. I at the time it happened, I was pretty much an agnostic or an atheist. I was a 30-year-old Harvard Business School professor living a very yuppie lifestyle. Social life, let us say, of a single 30-year-old Harvard Business School professor didn't leave much to be desired. And I was walking in nature early one morning, and from one moment to the next, I found myself in the immediate presence of God, looking back over my life as though I were looking back at it after death in the presence of God. And I saw everything that I would be happy about and everything that I would wish I had done differently. I saw that everything I did had a moral content that mattered for all eternity. I saw that everything that had ever happened to me in my life had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged by the hand of an all-loving God. I saw that my greatest regrets after I died would be every hour that I wasted not doing anything of value in the eyes of heaven, and also all the time and energy I wasted worrying about not being loved when every moment of my existence I was held in a sea of love greater than I could imagine, although I was unaware of it, by this all-loving God. And so essentially from one moment to the next, I knew the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve this God. I still didn't know who He was, and I remember praying at the time, mentally praying at the time, "Let me know Your name so I can worship and serve You properly. I don't mind if You're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if You're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if You're Krishna and I have to become Hindu, as long as You're not Christ and I have to become Christian." And I remember, you know, mentally saying that. And as a result, He didn't tell me who He was. But every night after that experience, before I went to sleep, I would say a short prayer to know the name of this God who had revealed Himself to me. And a year to the day after the initial experience, I had an extremely vivid feeling dream of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And when I woke up, I knew that it had been Christ on the beach, and I knew that it was all about Christianity, and I knew that I did want to, in fact, become as good a Christian as I possibly could.
All right, we got a caller for you. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, I'm curious about his thoughts on the lost tribes of Israel.
And the thoughts are all they are. They aren't great expertise. The only
I'll hang up and I'll listen on the radio. Is that okay?
That's great.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great.
One thing that was very interesting to me is that there was a tribe found in northern India on the Indian-Tibet border that called themselves B'nai Manasseh and who claimed to be the lost tribe of Manasseh. They looked like Indians and Tibetans. I mean, they racially, you know, resemble the people of that area. But they had, they practiced circumcision, they wore prayer shawls, they had essentially the stories from the Old Testament in their religious literature, in their worship. And they looked enough like one of the lost tribes that the government of Israel has accepted them as the lost tribe of Manasseh and given them the right of return, because, you know, Jews have an automatic right to become Israeli citizens.
Right.
So it certainly looks like one of the lost tribes was found, and that's kind of, again, very exciting to me from the perspective of the Second Coming, because it is one of the things that one would expect to see going by the Old Testament prophecies preceding the Second Coming, an ingathering of, you know, the lost tribes from around the world. I know that there are all kinds of theories about all kinds of people being lost tribes of Israel, and I can't make heads or tails of them. I know there are theories about American Indians and various Oriental groups and, you know, groups in Africa, and I just don't know the facts on the pro and con side of those cases. But this particular tribe, I was kind of blown away by the resemblances with, you know, Jewish ritual and Jewish worship and the Old Testament, and also by the fact that the Israeli government, which isn't an easy sell on these matters, bought their story.
Very, very interesting. Now, you've done all kinds of things since you made the conversion, numerous pilgrimages. You've helped edit books. Now, you were also on a local Catholic TV show in Boston called Fatima Today.
That's right. I was the host of Fatima Today.
Fatima, sorry. So, what do you know about the secrets of Fatima?
Well, I don't want to ruin my reputation. I'm not completely convinced that we know everything there is to know about the third secret of Fatima. You know, there were three secrets given to the children.
Right.
And the first two secrets, they revealed shortly thereafter. I think the second secret was, in fact, the existence of hell and what they saw going on in hell and how many people went to hell. The third secret was a prediction of future events. I think that you know that at the beatification of two of the children who saw the Blessed Virgin Mary a couple of years ago, the Holy Father revealed, or actually I think it was the Secretary of State of the Vatican who actually read it, something that was presented as the third secret of Fatima. Some people think it may not have been the entire story of the third secret. And I think that people who think there might still be something being withheld have a fair basis for that suspicion. You know, in other words, the suspicion is that there might have been something more apocalyptic and a kind of darker and more frightening that the Vatican still chose not to reveal.
Now, wouldn't you think the Vatican would be more than willing to share that kind of information? That's, you know, it would drive attendance up, it would help maybe convert a few people before it's too late. You know, that just seems to me, if there was something horrible coming, that the church would definitely let us know.
Well, I would like to think so, and I'm not saying that's not the case, but I at the same time respect the people who think there might be more, because there's some internal evidence that they base that argument on that I don't think can be dismissed out of hand. I mean, the before the third secret was revealed, what was revealed up till then was the Blessed Virgin Mary giving a description of the faith in Portugal, and then saying, you know, but on the other hand, and then the third secret kicks in, and it's hard to make the direct connection between where she ended in what had already been revealed and the vision that was presented. So some people say maybe she had something else to say before the vision. I don't know what to make of it. I'd like to agree with you that the Vatican would, in fact, give people the full story, but I think it's also possible that a hypothetical case that the third secret predicted a nuclear annihilation of half the world, I could understand why they wouldn't want to broadcast that.
Well, I don't. You know, if it's going to convert people, if it's going to get people to change their ways, boy.
Yeah, it's kind of certainly going to disturb a lot of people. Anyway, okay, I would like to agree with you. I'm not going to disagree with you that everything about the third secret was already given. But you know, to me, the jury is a little bit out on that.
I agree. Now, in all your teachings, all your learnings, everything you've been through, What is there a hell? Do you believe that there really is?
Is there a hell?
Yes.
Oh, I don't think there's any question.
Really?
I don't think there's any question. I mean, you can't take any of the visionary experience of saints seriously, and you can't take any of the Gospels seriously, and you can't even take the Old Testament seriously and not think there's a hell. I mean, virtually every saint who has visions of hell, and you know, whoever's talking to them, the Blessed Virgin Mary or Jesus is also telling them details about hell. The children of Fatima, who you brought up, I don't know if everyone knows the story of Fatima, but in 1917, three shepherd children in Portugal received a series of apparitions from the Blessed Virgin Mary. And in one of the appearances of the Blessed Virgin Mary, she showed the children hell. And I've seen photographs taken of the children a few days later, and they still look absolutely shell-shocked.
Yeah, that is true.
The Saint Teresa of Avila, who's one of the great mystic saints, you know, in the Catholic Church, the Lord showed her the place in hell that was kind of reserved for her before she converted and cleaned up her act. And that's kind of almost a normal situation for these saints to one way or another be exposed to hell. Jesus spoke far more about hell in the Gospels than he spoke about heaven. He was continually saying, you know, talking about being cast outside into, you know, the flames that don't perish, where there'll be wailing and gnashing of teeth, and so forth.
Now, what about,
and even the Old Testament and the Talmud, by the way, talks about hell too. Not to mention the Quran talks about hell. Not that I'm citing it as an authority.
Right. Now, you know what? I gotta. So that brings up my next question. What about people such as myself who live good, moral, upstanding lives, but I don't have any, you know, real religious connection to any church or whatnot? You know, am I going to hell too?
I don't think anyone is in a position of saying who's going to hell and who isn't going to hell. But I think one increases one's odds for avoiding it by living a moral life, and one also increases one's odds for avoiding it even more by establishing a prayerful relationship to God, and even better, establishing a prayerful relationship to God in, you know, his revealed true religion, which is Christianity.
So, now, out of all the different branches of Christianity that you could have chosen, what made you decide to go with the Catholic Church?
First of all, remember, it only became clear to me that that revelation of God involved Christ through another experience of the Blessed Virgin Mary. I woke up out of that dream the next morning in love with the Blessed Virgin Mary. I'm still in love with the Blessed Virgin Mary. I started going to Protestant churches, but the pastors weren't in love with the Blessed Virgin Mary. I heard some rather dismissive comments about her. And because I was in love with the Virgin Mary, I also was starting to go to Marian shrines. And every time I was present where a Mass was going on, I had a tremendous desire to receive communion, to receive the Eucharist, just an inexplicable desire to. And basically those two things defined the Catholic Church, a desire to receive communion and a veneration of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Hmm. Very interesting. All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us tonight, Roy. Tell us where we can get the book.
The book is widely available. It's published by Ignatius Press. It's in, you know, most Christian or religious bookstores. It's in the Barnes & Nobles in at least some areas. It's certainly at Amazon.com and all the internet booksellers. There are links to get it also on my website, which is salvationisfromthejews.com. Ignatius Press's website, which is ignatius.com, and as I said, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the large booksellers.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you for joining us tonight, Roy. I hope the book's a million seller and everybody gets your message. And especially, you know, we're not trying to revisit history. We're not trying to rewrite history. We're just trying to make it all a little clearer.
Thank you for what you're doing to that end.
Well, thank you, Roy. You have a great night.
You too. God bless.
Bye. Can you hang that up, please, Dave?